Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Statements and opinions by guests of Mysterious Radio are not to be considered as endorsed by sponsors or affiliated networks. Any rebroadcast, reproduction, or other use of this podcast without the express written consent of Mysterious Radio is strictly prohibited.
Get ready for a night filled with conspiracies, strange places, the paranormal, UFOs, legends, and myths from around the world. With your hosts, K-Town, on Mysterious Radio.
All right, thank you for joining me tonight for another edition of Mysterious Radio. I am your host, K-Town, and tonight my special guest is author and researcher Michael Brien. And he's here to discuss his book, The Road to Strange, UFOs, Aliens, and High Strangeness. This book is available, like all his others, on Amazon in Kindle, audiobook, and also paperback. I've had Michael on the show before talking about his other book, Road to Strangeness, and that dealt with paranormal travel stories, people that have faced like weird and strange encounters with the paranormal while traveling. So that was a very good interview, and I do suggest that you go back and listen to that if you haven't yet. But this one is strictly UFOs, aliens, and a whole bunch of high strangeness there. So you can read about close encounters with craft that defy explanation, face-to-face experiences with aliens, including abductions, the hybrid human-alien presence on Earth. He talks about men in black missing time slips, crop circles, and a lot more. And he co-wrote this book with the late Rosemary Ellen Guiley. So you know it's a good one. Let's go ahead and bring him out, my special guest, Michael Brien, here to talk about his book, The Road to Strange, UFOs, Aliens, and High Strangeness. All right, my special guest tonight, returning to the show, is author and researcher Michael Brien. And this time he's going to be discussing the book is called The Road to Strange, UFOs, Aliens, and High Strangeness. Michael, thank you for joining me tonight again on Mysterious Radio.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
All right. Now, so we covered your last book in the previous show, but for those that may not have had a chance to catch that particular show yet, can you just give us a little bit about your background, Michael, and what motivated you to write about UFOs and aliens?
Okay, well, around the age of 15 or so, I noticed the subject of UFOs. It was just beginning the modern era of UFOs or ufology, as we call it, was just beginning to be discussed and talked about. The modern era began with discs sighted over Mount Rainier, and that was really something. All the while, I had been interested in the paranormal a little bit and just kept an eye open towards it, and lo and behold, discovered that I had some of these sorts of odd experiences throughout my life, beginning in childhood. So it caught my attention. I think the UFO phenomena and the supernatural is often very much like, oh, now we have your attention. Pay attention. Something's going on. And I would say that I caught those bugs early on in my life, and I have not only paid attention, but I really got involved researching these subjects very much so. And I found throughout the years, I began to interview people, collect accounts of their experiences, got more involved in UFO organizations, got appointed to be the state director for Hawaii for the MUFON organization. That's the Mutual UFO Network, while I was living in Hawaii. And then later on, when I left Hawaii, I got appointed to the position of ambassador at large, which no portfolio. But what that meant was I was doing an awful lot of world travel. And I was meeting people right and left and interviewing them and collecting all kinds of stories.
That's awesome. All right. So have you yourself had a UFO sighting ever?
No, I haven't had a UFO sighting per se, but I had an experience while I was in my crib, if you can imagine. I saw what looked like an entity come through my Venetian blinds at my window and disappear into my toys closet. Now, nobody goes into my toy closet without permission, but I couldn't do very much about it, being kind of a prisoner in a crib, but I noticed it, and I didn't know what it was. At the time, I had no idea what an alien might be or an elf. All I do remember is that this was stuck with me. It was a visual hallucination or some kind of an experience. And that's about as far as I would say in the UFO area that I became involved. But like I say, I've been interviewing hundreds and hundreds of people, collecting their UFO stories. And I became a psychologist by training. And one of the things you study as a psychologist is, what are people like? How do we think? How do we behave? What can we know about being humans? And I guess I went a step further. I thought, well, I don't think we're the only intelligent beings in the universe, if we can call ourselves that. But anyway, that's basically the history of my beginnings in these subjects.
Okay. Michael, how do you discern if someone's being truthful or not?
That's a really good question. And I'll have to say, it's not an easy thing to tell if somebody's being truthful or not. And they could be truthful, but it may have no basis in reality. So I like to think back on listening to a video recently by the great late John Mack. For your audience who may not be familiar with him, he was a Harvard psychiatrist, head of the clinics, psychiatry clinic, I believe, at Harvard University for a period of time, an esteemed writer, well-respected. And he began to take an interest in people being a psychiatrist. He heard many, many stories from people, and they're very bizarre. And he said that it was really hard to know exactly what the basis in reality, quote unquote, these stories are, but the people were sincere. They exhibited very strong emotions when relating their experiences, often fear. And he was absolutely convinced that that these people believed their own stories. So in that sense, he believed most of these people he interacted with were being truthful. But the next step is, what can you know about the reality of these experiences? And that's a lot harder.
Yeah, I can imagine. You know, I've put to many UFO investigators about whether, well, it doesn't matter about any other any kind of investigator really that investigates strange phenomena, and they have to get firsthand accounts from these people, whether or not they kind of, you know, familiarize themselves with signs when someone's being deceptive, you know, because there are clear signs when someone's telling you a whopper. So I was wondering if that's something that you take into consideration as well.
Well, I do. You know, I'm an intelligent person. I've been around. I've been pretty highly educated. I've met thousands of people in my travels. You know, I'm as good as anybody else is in responding to a BS detector. And I can't say that I haven't been taken in by people. And often it's not even intentionally. For example, in my history of interviewing somewhere upwards to 2,000 people and collecting stories, I've come across one category of stories that people tell me that seem to be urban myths. That is, there's a commonly held story that may or may not be true about something, and the person that myth goes on and on and on, and it kind of perpetuates itself, self-perpetuates itself. And then, lo and behold, I get a story from somebody, a complete story about something that happened to them, and I'm scratching my head. I've heard this before, and it turns out that maybe I've heard two or three or four or five urban myths like this that people were relating to me as if it was their own. People have these strange experiences. They're eager and anxious to share these because they want validation from other people. They often want to know, am I crazy? Am I the only one that has this experience? By and large, people share these unusual experiences because they want to learn more about it themselves. And you feel as if they're telling you the truth most of the time, but you never really totally know.
Yeah. I guess there's really no way you can totally know. You got to kind of use your gut instinct there.
The late Stanton Friedman always used to say he had a gray basket, and he'd hear a lot of things from a lot of people, and he would file them temporarily in the so-called gray basket, not a basket full of grays, but a basket that he could pull out a story or an account and take a look at it later on when there's more evidence, more information on it. And it was always like a temporary holding pen for stories that he wasn't sure of one way or the other, So we all have our own kind of temporary holding pens, gray baskets for stories that we've heard.
Yeah. All right. Very good. Let's go ahead and get into some of the stories. I'm interested to know whether you've been able to gather any sightings from pilots over the years.
I have spoken with a few pilots. Not that many. I would defer to Richard Haynes, Dr. Richard Haynes from NASA. He was a psychologist that worked for NASA, and he has a database of some 3,000 or more reports from pilots. But from a few people that have told me a story or two here and there, I know that the pilots are there. They're around. They've had experiences, and they've been very hesitant in general to share them because they don't want to get labeled as crazy and grounded, put behind a desk rather than being a pilot. So pilots have often been very, very wary of sharing their experiences. But that's opening up more these days. That's easing up.
Yeah. Tell us about something that they've told you.
Well, I talked to a British Airways pilot who claimed that he had seen anomalous lights outside of his aircraft. He had a couple of experiences. It's in the book. One of his experiences was over England, flying for British Airways. And he had another very strange experience over Puerto Rico, which involved covering a great distance, but not possibly within the normal allotted time. And he doesn't know exactly what happened to him, but it sounds like he may have had a missing time experience in his flight, of all things. You can't imagine something like that would happen. But it's typical of what you might hear about the so-called Bermuda Triangle. That is, pilots might tell you they can't really account for all the time in their flights. So something happened anomalous, but they don't know exactly what it was.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Okay. Now, you had a... The book, by the way, is just fantastic. I mean, you really have done great job with gathering these stories from people from all walks of life. And let me just ask you this real quick while I'm flipping through the book. In the last book, I know that you use aliases for these people. Is it the same way for this book?
I'm not specifically aware right this second of who I did that with, but, you know, kind of leafing through it. I don't think I had any aliases that I can think of in this one.
So people were willing to give their real names.
Oh, yeah. And eager to. And the people that shared stories with me were not working in any kinds of fields that they were especially wary. And I met lots of people at UFO conferences. So they're people who have sought out conferences in order to learn more. And I found as a group of people, there's no people more than those who go to conferences who they're so eager to share because they want to learn more. They want to find out more. Let me give you a great example. I knew a professor of Japanese languages and literature at the University of Hawaii. We became good friends. Well, he had a UFO sighting of a series of discs over mountains in Italy after the end of World War II. And then 26 years later, he had a close-up and personal experience and a witness in the car that he was in of a disc-shaped UFO craft that passed over the highway in Honolulu. That was a highway I've gone over many times myself. He was so eager to learn and study and read and talk to people, and he came to virtually every meeting we ever held in Honolulu. He had no fear, no compunction, no hesitancy to delve into these subjects, which he honestly felt that he had experiences, and he was not afraid to be public with his experiences. He didn't feel like he had anything to lose. He wasn't going to lose his tenure as a professor at the University of Hawaii, for instance.
Had that been the only one he'd had, or?
No, that was his second experience. The first one was in Italy, and the second one happened in Honolulu. Now, having one experience is one thing. Not everybody has that. But having a second experience, and you begin to wonder, is it accidental, even if it's 25 years later?
Yeah. I mean, have you had people that have came to you and said, I feel like I'm being chosen to witness these sightings?
I think I've had people say to me that they pulled over on the side of a highway and they were looking at what was so obvious in the sky and happening, but they didn't think other people even saw these things, even perceived them. So it leads to the possibility that some people do have these experiences, whereas others around them do not. You hear abduction accounts of people who claim that they've been taken and examined, whatever the purposes are, and their spouses weren't even aware of it happening to them. So it's And then there are occasions where many, many people are all out pointing to objects in the sky and everyone's seeing it. So at times it appears to be selective and other times it doesn't. And that's one of the mysteries of this phenomenon.
Right, right. I found something really interesting also in your book. You talk about the hybrid human-alien presence on Earth. Where did you get those? I mean, is that something that people came to you and told you about that? Or how did you get on that one?
Well, I was investigating one case in the early 90s of a supposed, alleged, human maybe combined with an alien. I mean, you never know this for certain, but it was an interesting story that had consequences, had witnesses, went back to a military base. This woman that was relating this experience said that she had a phone book, a phone number in notes where she claimed this was a friend of her husband's at the time, and he was a witness. And there was the phone number, and it was verified. There was a lot of, shall we say, circumstantial evidence surrounding this. In this particular instance, the girl that was the subject of the idea of a possible combination of human and alien left the college where she was a student. And we obtained a record from the college that substantiated that this person left the college at that time when it was part of the story that she left the college. So, you know, you don't have definitive proof of these things. And the notion of the combination human-alien hybrid is an extremely rare one that you hardly ever hear of. So it's hard to rule it in. And, you know, you can't really totally rule it out. Who knows where to draw the line of what's real and what isn't real? That makes this both exciting and difficult at the same time. It's a real challenge to try to understand and learn things about that. That's such a controversial notion. And one person that has involved himself quite a bit is Professor David Jacobs from Temple University, retired now, and he has books out there talking about the so-called human-alien hybrid phenomena. So that's, he's a person that has specialized in that and has apparently hypnotized hundreds and hundreds of people. And so he's a proponent of that concept. It's very rare that you hear about such things, as far as I'm concerned, you know, in my involvement in ufology, but I have heard of it, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think the first time I heard of it was a researcher, actually he produces documentaries too, his name's Ali Sadatan, and he talks about how in Canada, they believe that these alien human hybrids are being housed in Canada. It's just fascinating. His interviews are just fascinating. Some of his research is that, that he's worked years on trying to make people aware of it. But I have heard Linda Moulton Howe talk about it quite a bit. And I think Timothy Good, I'm pretty sure, everybody right. knows who he is. He talked about it quite a bit himself. So some really believe that that is truly something that is real, very real. I'm not sure.
Well, here's a real takeaway from what you're saying, and that is, you know, for the longest period of time, people just thought, well, these are things flying around in our skies, you know, but mosquitoes fly around in the sky too, and we know that mosquitoes have agendas. But what I'm saying is they're around, and they're not just flying around. They probably have their own agendas of why they're here in our skies.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Yeah, I like that. Mosquitoes have agendas. They do.
I hope it's better than that.
That's funny. All right. So, okay. Have you gotten any, Have you gotten anyone that has come to you and said, we witnessed something near some of these ancient sites around the world?
That's really good. I've heard UFO accounts in just about any time I've gone to England, the UK, and talked to people.
Concerning crop circles or what?
Well, no, I'm talking about specifically UFO sightings. But I also did interview people about crop circles. And it's hard to know, you know, what the relationship is between crop circles and other phenomena. But we know that the UK has an ancient history. And we know there's a lot of strange ancient history. We don't know how some of the great monoliths were created with the technology in those ancient times compared to the present. So we get a hint of it. That's pretty prevalent in the UK, this historically ancient sites. And then, you know, of course, that's where largely the crop circle thing began. And people are asserting there's a connection between some crop circles and maybe UFOs. And some people have claimed that they've seen UFOs in the vicinity of where crop circle formations have taken place. But again, that's just one of many, many, many sub aspects of ufology. It's hard to know where to draw the line, what things are related, what aren't. But there certainly seems to be a lot of strange things going on.
Oh, yeah, definitely. All right. So let's get back to your book here. You have a very interesting report here of some grass eating aliens from Janine Toucher. I think that's what
right,
it is. Maybe.
Right. Toucher. Yeah. That's just a wonderful story with a lot of details. And she was a young girl at the time. So she witnessed things and didn't know really quite how to interpret all of it. I mean, we cannot imagine that a visitor from space would pull a clump of grass out and eat it. But, you know, we're always told, do as the natives do. and maybe extraterrestrial visitors or interdimensional visitors might do things to elicit reactions from people. I mean, there's another story, a classic story, where a man felt he was served pancakes, of all things, in a UFO. I mean, it just makes no sense whatsoever. And supposedly, of course, we don't know absolutely for certain, but supposedly one of these things was analyzed and found out to resemble pretty much the texture and components of pancakes. So again, you know, I hesitate to give any particular specific thing credulity, but you do hear tons of stories.
Yeah, yeah. That is interesting about the grass eating aliens there.
Do as the natives do.
Yeah. Okay, so there's another one here. It says someone was punished. Let me see here. I found it in your book here. It says punished for witnessing a UFO, and I can't find it. But
okay, yeah,
you remember that?
Well, yeah, yeah. I mean, I remember. Yeah, the story, the exact details of it are not coming forward to me exactly. But you know, UFOs are to a lot of people very scary things, difficult to accept. And there's just no doubt that some people have been, as kids, see these things, report these things. Now, not only is it hard for a parent necessarily to accept everything, literally, that a child experiences, but the component is that it's strange. The parent doesn't know how to explain it. The parent is afraid the child might get fixated on it and blow it up into something larger than it is. And what do you do with fearful things sometimes is you try to suppress it. And so it wouldn't surprise me that a child would be chided by a parent. No, don't talk about this. Forget it. Even in my own life, I mean, to give a little example of that, as a kid, I got interested in the pendulum technique, you know, where you hold a crystal by a string and kind of elicit yes, no answers to questions, so on and so forth. Well, I was just curious about it. I didn't know if it had any credence or if it was valid or not valid, but I had it kind of like a toy. And it was one of those things, by the way, that was in my toy closet, so stay out of my toy closet. But apparently my mother didn't like the idea that I would have any interest in something like that whatsoever. And lo and behold, it disappeared from my closet. Now, maybe the elf took it. I don't know. But I think that was in years that were later than that sighting that I had of some kind of entity coming through my window into my closet. Mm-hmm. So you don't know how far to extend the envelope and listening to stories and thinking about them. It's hard to determine what's real and what isn't.
You're exactly right.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. In Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. In Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course.
Right again. Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing Board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
For a limited time, visit Miro.com/brainstorm now and get a free business plan trial to unlock even more brainstorming tools like private mode and voting. That's MIRO.com/brainstorm now.
Michael,
thank you.
Is it nice to be right?
It is. It's nice to get vindication on some of the weird subjects that we involve ourselves in.
Yeah.
It's nice to learn something, gain some knowledge of it. Sure.
Yeah. There you go. Now, you know, let's see here. I think that I've interviewed one guy that talks about, actually two, that talk about the prevalent UFO sightings in Washington, D.C. But the thing about those sightings is the only way that he was able to capture those was through a very, very sophisticated, high-powered camera. And because he says these things are flying in and out of that area so fast, you can't see them, you know, with a human eye. But anyway, you have one in your book, and I'm wondering, is this the only one you've gotten from Washington, D.C., or are you getting those quite a bit from that city?
Well, I wouldn't say I've gotten a lot of it, but this is a really good friend of mine who's been an investigator of unusual phenomena. We've known each other for years. And I used to go with him to visit some crop circle formations. His name is George Wingfield, and he used to be the editor of a monthly crop circle journal in the UK. And he described to me a sighting in Washington, D.C., of all places. I mean, well, you go back to, I think it was 1952, and there were all kinds of UFO sightings over the city. There's the famous 1952 flap of UFOs over Washington, D.C. And here this is, I'm sure this was in the late 90s, early 2000s, that my friend George and his wife at the time were near the Washington Monument, and they saw these things. And you wonder, my God, how could this be right over Washington, D.C.? And were there other people to have witnessed this? I didn't hear anything more about from anyone else.
What did he say he saw? What did he see?
He saw like round objects moving very rapidly across the sky that he could not attribute to anything else. I mean, he had no other explanation. Now, he didn't come right out and assert that these were alien aircraft or anything like that, but he said these were not ordinary planes. These were not anything that he could think of. And like I say, he was very trustworthy, very knowledgeable about things. So again, you listen to these stories, you record them, you ask questions, you have a discussion, and you try to make an intelligent assessment of what you think it might be. In the case of his experience over DC, I didn't have any other really good, viable alternative explanation for it. So that's why I included that story. It was somebody that I found trustworthy, had nothing to gain by making up a story. And so I thought it was strong enough to include. Now, I've had other interviews with people, particularly who live on Bainbridge Island off of Seattle, where I live, who knew nothing of the subject of UFOs, but yet they had their experiences right here in the Seattle, Bainbridge Island area. And these were not people sophisticated at all in these subjects. They describe what they've seen in the skies, and they say, I know what I saw. I know what I saw. And they're just credible, normal, everyday people with interesting stories and experiences. Now,
they're seeing things over that city? I mean, I don't know where you live at, but is it
the city? Well, Bainbridge Island is it's west of the city of Seattle. There's the Puget Sound waterway that separates the Olympic Peninsula from Seattle. So that area has been known for sightings. Washington State is always up there in terms of sightings that people report. The Pacific Northwest, and there's been a history of these sightings. One of the most interesting investigations of UFO sightings is from Peter Davenport. Have you ever had him as a guest on your show?
Not yet. No. I know who he is, though.
Yeah, absolutely want to get him. He's been collecting UFO accounts all over, but particularly he has, because he resides near Spokane, Washington, an excellent collection of reports of people living in the Pacific Northwest. That's kind of where it all got started, with Kenneth Arnold flying over Mount Rainier in 1947, I guess a month or so, I'm not sure exactly what difference of time was, when the Roswell, New Mexico famous case took place in July of 1947. That was the beginning of the modern era of ufology. And like I say, it started in the Pacific Northwest in our area. So there's quite a bit here.
I'm really interested to know whether people are seeing certain shapes of UFOs up there where you are.
I wouldn't say that there was necessarily a defining shape of these things that are, you know, particular to the Pacific Northwest. But it's interesting that the concept, the description of a flying saucer like a stone skipping over water, that, I believe, came about through Kenneth Arnold, the private pilot that I was talking about. But it's interesting that his description of what he saw nine objects flying over Mount Rainier, that they were chevron-shaped. Now, I know a lot of people don't know exactly what a chevron looks like, but if you Google it, it'll be sort of like a, what did the Australians toss up in the air and it comes back to you? What is that called? I just can't think of it for a minute. You know, it's kind of a...
What is it?
A V-shaped
Oh, like a boomerang.
Yeah. Kind of like boomerang shape, but with a point coming out somewhat in the open end of it. It wasn't the classic Kenneth Arnold sightings were not typically flying saucers or plate shaped, but they were more like a half a plate with a point coming out in the open side and kind of like a crescent. So a lot of people don't realize that those first sightings were not necessarily in the form of discs. They come in all kinds of shapes and sizes. They're reported in all sorts of shapes and sizes, triangles, spheres, discs. There just seemed to be such a variety of them. You'd think that this was Grand Central Station in the United States for UFOs.
What about, has anyone given you any photos or videos that you found very telling about what they've witnessed?
I myself have not received photos or videos.
Have you seen any over the years that you think are pretty authentic or?
Well, I do. And let me talk about that for a second. And that is some of the interviews I've gotten are from different UFO conferences and festivals and so on and so forth. And I've gone a number of times to the famous McMinnville, Oregon festival that takes place in McMinnville. And it commemorates a very famous sighting by a farmer right outside of that town, McMinnville, in western Oregon. And it's a photo of a circular shape, a plate-shaped, disc-shaped craft. Is way before the time of Photoshop, and it just does not seem to be something tossed by a person up in the air and photographed. There was the famous Trent Farm UFO, and it certainly looks like a solid craft with a little protuberance at the top. And over the years, I've seen many, many photos presented by people as evidence. Of course, it's been much easier to fake in the modern era with all the new capabilities of computers to do that sort of thing. But that was way back. I've seen also other ones, famous old photos over Honolulu, over the Kodak Hula show. The famous Hula show is a disc-shaped object in the skies photographed. There are lots of good photos. And recently we've seen the U.S. Navy photos of these objects that they labeled as TikToks, or not the TikTok phenomena, but
Tic Tacs,
the candies, not the internet sensation, the candies. Well, nobody was making these things up in the Navy gun photos, taking these objects. So, yes, there are probably quite a few good, legitimate photos around. Very few of us are photographic experts, but authorities, people who are in the know of these things, have asserted often enough that there are photos that do not seem to be faked. They seem to be legitimate.
Yeah, with many of those that I really find convincing are the ones that are coming out of Mexico. Something really, really interesting to these beings in Mexico. I don't know what it is. And I forgot the researcher's name. Say again?
Yeah. I was saying, isn't that something? Mexico has certainly been a hotbed of interest in UFOs. No question about it.
Yeah, that is interesting. Let's see here. What about, have you gotten any reports of anybody that says they were taken or continue to be taken by these beings at all? Have you got anything like that?
Well, I have talked to quite a few people over the years with these experiences. One of the stories in the book, maybe you'll recall this one in particular, was a woman who claimed she was getting messages through a radio, and she would go outside at her home at night and turn on the radio and claim and tell her husband and her son about these messages, and that they were encouraging her to come and meet them and maybe board a craft and spend some time with them. And of course, the father and the son were humoring her, because I don't think they were absolutely convinced of this. So anyway, they go to this area in California. It's in the book. I just can't remember the specific town. Borrego Springs, that's it. And they go there because she feels like she's going to have contact with them if they go there, and it would be safe, so on and so forth. And the husband said, well, what happens if you disappear and you don't come back? Are you going to just leave me with our kids and that's it? So, you know, she was having this hesitancy to follow through with this. But anyway, they go there. They're in Borrego Springs. And they go into this little general store. And she goes up somewhat naively to the guy behind the counter. And she says, where do you see the UFOs around here? And, of course, the guy's reaction is, lady, come on, lady. I've got things to do. I'm too busy. Nothing like that happens here. Goodbye. Have a nice day. So she leaves. And that night, she gets convinced by her husband, all right, don't do this. You really can't do this. Let's not pursue this. And she doesn't. And she, the next day, goes into that general store, and that same guy is there. He says, lady, did you see the UFO? Did you see it? And she says, what UFO? What are you talking about? He says, yeah. Lots of people reported this. Here, look at this newspaper. Newspaper says UFO seen over Borrego Springs, something like that. And that's her story. It's interesting, and I wish I could find that newspaper, but not much luck in that. But, you know, there was a situation where she was encouraged to, maybe interact. But in the end, they got frightened and they withdrew from that. Now, let's fast forward 20 years from when I recorded that. Not that long ago, I went to a UFO meeting here up in the Seattle area, and I was talking to a lady who was talking to me about that same general area of California, desert area, saying that she drove along a highway there one night, and she saw people out there, cars with no people around, some people that seemed to be out of it, that was one was sitting in a truck, and his wife was sitting like on a lounge chair out just on by the road in the desert, kind of in a mild stupor. And I put the two together in a way. I was thinking, my goodness, what if people have been sort of lured out to experiences for whatever the purposes are? Could they appear like these people? Maybe they're vehicles on the side of the road and they're not around for the time being. Could there be a connection with that sort of experience with what this lady claimed was happening to her? It's just an interesting parallel and not an easy one to follow up on, but I just find it curious. Maybe people are, in some occasions, tempted out and returned, not hurt or anything. Maybe. It's just an interesting indirect story connecting with one that I recorded and put in the book.
Yeah, that's fascinating about that woman was getting those messages through that radio. Wow.
Well, they thought she was crazy. They thought she was nuts. And then she got some vindication from that general store clerk, who wouldn't, by the way, give her the paper. It's the last one. I'm going to keep it.
You know what? Let me put this question to you. I mean, right now, they could really just say the government's been working with aliens all along. I mean, they could really unleash a whole library full of, you know, authentic video to the public, and no one would believe it. I mean, the CGI and the ability to fake these videos is so good now. they could just put it out there and no one would believe it. So how would one, if this was truly concerning, and some believe it is, how would you get people to take it seriously?
Well, the big question is, this is kind of interesting. I've been telling people about this for 50 years. I've been screaming, Henny Penny, Henny Penny, the sky is falling. The sky is falling. And they said, oh, yeah, sure. You know, and they always knew I was a student of these subjects, but they couldn't really relate to it that much. Okay, now 2019, 2020, I get emails, I get phone calls, I get text messages. Hey, did you hear what the Navy said? Did you see the New York Times? And I say to my friends, I'm the one that told you about it 20 years ago. Now you're telling me? Oh, well, thanks. Nobody believed me then, but they're now starting to believe me now. Okay, so what happens if this gets revealed and how? Well, that's been the subject of discussion and controversy virtually any UFO meeting I ever went to, and I've gone to easily 100 of them. How would disclosure take place? Who would do it? How would it be done? There's one school of thought that says disclosure ain't going to happen because you can't handle the truth. Maybe it's too fearful, maybe not. Or maybe there's been so much covering up and people's careers ruined over this stuff. And maybe there's military technology involved. There's a lot of aspects to this. And some of the old timers that have been, into this subject as long as I have are very skeptical about revealing the truth of this stuff really anytime soon, because there's probably reasons why it's not.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, if it does come out, I'd like to live to see it, you know.
Well, that's
if,
it.
If we do get to see them, I mean, I'd like to see it.
Be careful. You might get what you wish for.
Well, let me take it back. Only if it's in a good way, you know, if it's a good thing, you know.
I hope so.
But we might not have a choice in the matter. Go ahead.
Well, that's true. And if it was, some people say, look, if it was all that horrible and all that bad and all that dangerous and all that fearful, wouldn't something of horrible have already happened? It seems like this presence, whatever it is, has been with us maybe from the beginning. From when we first appeared on the earth. It's not necessarily an immediate new thing. Oh, you know, this big buzz going on about, well, look, all this stuff is happening. Well, we've had UFOs for hundreds of years, ancient texts, ancient paintings, classical paintings in Europe, Middle Ages show flying saucers in the sky in paintings. I mean, this isn't just something that happened overnight. Believe me, if they wanted to take over the planet, if they haven't already done so, it could very easily have been done by now. That's for sure.
You're exactly right. This has been a very, very interesting interview here. I've enjoyed having you. Michael, before we go, please take a moment to tell my listeners where they can find out more information about you or anything else you're working on.
All right. Thank you. I have a website, www.michaelbryan, that's my full name, at .com, and M-I-C-H-A-E-L-B-R-E-I-N. You can email me at michaelbryan@gmail.com. You can see my books, and they're available on Amazon and just about virtually any other way you like to get your ebooks or your audio books. And so you just look up Michael Bryan, The Road to Strange, and they're available there. Now, if you are one of these people that likes to have a signed autographed copy, I'm happy to do that. But that you need to email me directly and let me know that's what you want to do.
And I'll have that email in the show notes, if you don't mind if I do that. Is that okay?
Sure. I'd love to have you do that. Thank you.
All right. The book is called The Road to Strange, UFOs, Aliens, and High Strangeness. Michael, many blessings to you, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. I enjoyed being here with you. Anytime.
All right. That's going to do it for tonight's edition. I want to thank my special guest, Michael Bryan, for joining me again. His book is called The Road to Strange, UFOs, Aliens, and High Strangeness, and it is available right now on Amazon and Kindle audiobook and also paperback. I want to thank my producer tonight, Kim, and the Mysterious Radio team. I am your host, K-Town. I want you to stay safe and stay healthy, and I will see you next time on Mysterious Radio.
Like the show? Get more Mysterious Radio on our website. And don't forget to visit our Twitter and Facebook page.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile Coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next, you need the team to act on feedback fast. So you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
For a limited time, visit Miro.com/retro now for a free business plan trial to unlock advanced retro tools like private mode, voting, and two-way Jira syncing. That's Miro.com/retro now.